she became alarmed at his eroding condition. Though Delk was not a psychiatrist or psychologist, she had received extensive training in the detection and nature of mental illness. Part of her job as a capital defense attorney was to observe such problems and try to get adequate treatment. She relied on the opinions of mental health experts, but it was difficult with Ron because a proper examination was impossible. As part of the non-contact policy at H Unit, no one could sit in the same room with the prisoner, not even his lawyer. A psychiatrist trying to examine Ron had to do so through a sheet of glass while talking to him on the phone. Delk arranged for a Dr. Pat Fleming to do a psychological evaluation of Ron, as required in post-conviction proceedings. Dr. Fleming made 3 attempts but was unable to complete her assessment. Her patient was agitated, delusional, non-cooperative, and hallucinating. The staff informed Dr. Fleming that such behavior was not at all unusual. It was obvious that he was a very disturbed man who was in no condition to assist his attorney or function in any meaningful way. She was severely restricted in her attempt to evaluate Ron because she was not allowed a confidential visit in which she could sit in the same room to question, observe, and administer tests. Dr. Fleming met with the staff physician on H Unit and detailed her concerns. Later, she was assured that Ron had been seen by mental health professionals from within the prison, but she saw no improvement. She strongly recommended a commitment to Eastern State Hospital for an extended period to stabilize Ron and properly evaluate him. Her recommendation was denied. Leslie Delk hammered away at the prison officials. She met with the correctional staff, the medical staff, and the various wardens to lodge her complaints and demand better treatment. Promises were made, then ignored. Benign efforts were made, slight changes in Ron's medications, but he received no significant treatment. She documented her frustrations with a series of letters to the prison officials. She visited Ron as often as possible, and when she was certain his condition could not worsen, it did. Leslie worried that he might die at any time. While the medical staff struggled to treat Ron, the correctional staff was having great fun at his expense. For amusement, some of the prison guards enjoyed playing with the new intercom on H Unit. Each cell had a 2-way speaker to the control room, yet another smart toy to keep the guards as far away from the inmates as possible. But it wasn't far enough. "Ron, this is God," a haunting voice called into Ron's cell deep in the night. "Why did you kill Debbie Carter?" A pause, then the guards would snicker as they heard Ron screaming through his door. "I didn't kill anybody! I am innocent!" His deep, raspy voice rattled through the southwest quad and disrupted the quiet. The seizure would last an hour or so, upsetting the other inmates but greatly humoring the guards. When things were quiet, the voice returned. "Ron, this is Debbie Carter. Why did you kill me?" His tormented screams would go on and on. "Ron, this is Charlie Carter. Why did you kill my daughter?" The other inmates begged the guards to stop it, but they were having too much fun. Rick Rojan believed that 2 of the more sadistic guards, in particular, lived for the fun of mistreating Ron. The abuse went on for months. "Just ignore them," Rick pleaded with his cellmate. "If you ignore them, they'll quit." Ron couldn't grasp this idea. He was determined to convince everyone around him that he was innocent, and bawling it at the top of his lungs seemed the appropriate way. Often, when he couldn't scream any longer, when he was physically spent or too hoarse to continue, he would stand with his face close to the speaker and whisper incoherently for hours. Leslie Delk finally heard of the fun and games and fired off a letter on October 12, 1992, to the manager of H Unit. It read, in part, "Also, I had mentioned to you that I had been hearing from different folks that Ron was being harassed through the intercom by certain guards who apparently find it humorous to taunt the crazies and get them to react. I am continuing to hear about this problem, and most recently heard that Officer Martin walked up to the door of Ron's cell and started harassing him and taunting him. I believe that the content of these usually revolve around Ricky Jo Simmons and Deborah Sue Carter. From what I understand, Officer Reading stepped in to get Officer Martin to quit his behavior, but had to repeatedly tell him to quit harassing Ron before Martin actually stopped. I have heard Officer Martin's name from several different sources now as being one of the people who routinely harass Ron, and so I would like to know if you could investigate this matter and take appropriate action. Maybe it would be beneficial for you to have some training sessions for your guards who have to deal with those inmates who are mentally ill. Not all of the guards were cruel. A female guard stopped by Ron's cell late one night for a chat. He looked awful and said he was starving, said he hadn't eaten for days. She believed him. She left and returned a few minutes later with a jar of peanut butter and a loaf of stale bread. In a letter to Renee, Ron said he enjoyed the feast immensely, and there wasn't a crumb left over. Kim Marks was an investigator with the Oklahoma Indigent Defense System who ultimately spent more time on H Unit with Ron than anyone else. When she was first assigned his case, she reviewed the trial transcripts, reports, and exhibits. She was a former newspaper reporter, and her curiosity drove her to at least question Ron's guilt. She made a list of potential suspects, 12 in all, and most with criminal backgrounds. Glenn Gore was number one, for all the obvious reasons. He was with Debbie the night she was murdered. They had known each other for years, thus he could gain access to her apartment without force. He had a wretched history of violence against women. He had pointed the finger at Ron. Why had the cops shown so little interest in Gore? The deeper Kim probed into the police reports and the trial itself, the more she became convinced that Ron's protests were well-grounded. She visited him many times on H Unit and, like Leslie Delk, watched him completely unravel. She approached each visit with a mix of curiosity and apprehension. Never had she seen an inmate age as rapidly as Ron. His dark brown hair was grayer with each visit, and he was not yet 40. He was gaunt and ghost-like, due in no small part to the lack of sunshine. His clothes were dirty and fit badly. His eyes were hollow and deeply troubled. A major part of her job was to determine if the client had mental problems, then attempt to find not only adequate treatment but also expert witnesses. It was obvious to her, and obvious to any layperson, that he was mentally ill and suffering greatly from his condition. Early on, she was stiff-armed by the DOC policy of keeping death row inmates out of the special care unit. Like Dr. Foster, Kim would fight that battle for years. She located and reviewed the 1983 videotape of Ron's second polygraph. Though at that time he'd already been diagnosed as depressed and bipolar, and perhaps schizophrenic, he was coherent, under control, and able to present himself as a normal person. But 9 years later, there was nothing normal about him. He was delusional, out of touch with reality, and consumed with obsessions. Ricky Jo Simmons, religion, the liars at his trial, lack of money, Debbie Carter, the law, his music, the massive lawsuit he would one day file against the state, his baseball career, the abuses and injustices to which he was being subjected. She talked to the staff and heard their reports of his ability to scream for an entire day. Then she got a good dose of it. Because of the peculiarities of the layout of H Unit, the women's restroom had a vent that carried sounds from the southwest quad, where Ron was housed. On a trip to the restroom, she was stunned to hear him bellowing like a madman. It rattled her, and working with Leslie, she pushed even harder to force the prison to provide better treatment. They tried to get an exception to move him to the SCU. They tried to have him evaluated at Eastern State. Their efforts were futile. In June 1992, Leslie Delk, as part of the post-conviction process, filed an application for a hearing to determine mental competency in the District Court of Pontotoc County. Bill Peterson filed an objection, and the court denied the request. This denial was immediately appealed to the Court of Criminal Appeals, where it was upheld. In July, she filed an extensive application for post-conviction relief. Her claims were based primarily on the voluminous records of Ron's mental health, and she argued that his lack of competency should have been addressed at trial. 2 months later, post-conviction relief was denied, and Leslie appealed again to the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals. Not surprisingly, she lost again. The next step was a routine and hopeless appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. A year later, it issued a perfunctory denial. Other routine filings were made, more routine denials were entered, and when all state remedies were exhausted on August 26, 1994, the execution of Ron Williamson was set by the Court of Criminal Appeals for September 27, 1994. He had been on death row for 6 years and 4 months. After 2 years of freedom, Greg Wilhoit was dragged back into a courtroom to once again face charges of murdering his wife. After he left McAllister, he settled in Tulsa and tried to reestablish something close to a normal life. It was not easy. He carried emotional and psychological scars from his ordeal. His daughters, now 8 and 9 years old, were being raised by some friends from church, two school teachers, and their lives were quite stable. His parents and sisters were supportive, as always. His case had gathered some attention. His trial lawyer, George Briggs, had mercifully passed away, but not before having his license to practice revoked by the state. Several prominent criminal lawyers contacted Greg and wanted to represent him. Lawyers are attracted to cameras, like ants to a picnic, and Greg was amused to see so much interest in his case. But it was an easy choice. His pal, Mark Barrett, had won his release, and Greg was confident he would now win his freedom. During his first trial, the most damaging evidence was the testimony of the state's two bite mark experts. Both told the jury that the wound on Kathy Wilhoit's breast had been left there by her estranged husband. The Wilhoit family found a leading bite mark expert, Dr. Thomas Krause of Kansas. Dr. Krause was stunned at the discrepancies between Greg's dental impression and the actual wound. The two were drastically different. Mark Barrett then sent the bite mark to 11 nationally renowned experts, many of whom usually testified on behalf of the prosecution. They included the FBI's top bite mark consultant and the expert who testified against Ted Bundy. The verdict was unanimous. All 12 bite mark experts concluded that Greg Wilhoit had to be excluded. The comparisons were not even close. At an evidentiary hearing, an expert for the defense identified 20 major discrepancies between Greg's teeth and the bite mark and testified that each one conclusively excluded Greg. But the prosecutor pushed on and insisted on a trial, which quickly became a farce. Mark Barrett successfully excluded the state's bite mark experts, then destroyed the credibility of the DNA man called by the state. After the prosecution rested, Mark Barrett made a forceful motion to dismiss the evidence presented by the state and direct a verdict in favor of Greg Wilhoit. Then the judge called for a recess, and they went to lunch. When they returned, and when the jury was back and the courtroom was settled, the judge, in a rare move, announced that the motion would be granted. The case was dismissed. "Mr. Wilhoit," he said, "you are now a free man." After a long night of celebrating with his family and friends, Greg Wilhoit raced to the airport the next morning and flew to California, never to return to Oklahoma unless it was to visit his family or fight the death penalty. 8 years after Kathy's murder, he was finally a free man. By chasing the wrong suspect, the police and prosecutors had allowed the real killer's trail to grow cold. He has yet to be found. The new death chamber on H Unit was working just fine. On March 10, 1992, Robin Leroy Parks, male black, age 43, was executed for the 1978 murder of a gas station attendant. He had been on the row for 13 years. 3 days later, Olin Randall Robison, male white, age 46, was executed for murdering a couple after he broke into their rural home in 1980. Ron Williamson was to be the third man strapped to a gurney on H Unit and offered the opportunity to say a few final words. On August 30, 1994, Ron was greeted at his cell door by a menacing squad of frowning guards who wanted to take him somewhere. He was cuffed at the ankles and wrists, and a belly chain linked all the hardware together. This was something serious. As usual, he was gaunt, dirty, unshaven, and unstable, and the guards gave him as much room as possible. Officer Martin was one of the five. Ron was led out of H Unit into a van and driven the short distance to the administrative offices at the front of the prison. Surrounded by his entourage, he was taken to the warden's office, to a room with a long conference table where many people were waiting to witness something dramatic. Still shackled and guarded closely by his sentries, he was seated at one end of the table. The warden was at the other, and he began the meeting by introducing Ron to the numerous staff members seated around the table, all looking rather glum. "A real pleasure to meet you all." Ron was then handed a notification, which the warden began reading. "You have been sentenced to die for the crime of murder at 12:01 a.m. on Tuesday, September 27, 1994. The purpose of this meeting is to inform you of the rules and procedures to be followed for the next 30 days and to discuss certain privileges you may be afforded." Ron became upset and said that he hadn't killed anyone. Maybe he'd done some bad things in his life, but murder wasn't one of them. The warden kept reading, and Ron again insisted that he did not kill Debbie Carter. The warden and the unit manager chatted with him for a few minutes and calmed him down. They were not there to judge him, they said, but they were just following the rules and procedures. But Ron had a video of Ricky Simmons confessing to the crime, and he wanted to show it to the warden. Again, he denied killing Debbie, and he rambled on about somehow getting on television in Ada to profess his innocence. He mentioned his sister going to college in Ada. The warden continued reading. "On the morning prior to the date of execution, you will be placed in a special cell, where you will remain until the time of execution. While in this cell and until the time of execution, you will be under constant surveillance by correctional officers." Ron interrupted again, yelling that he did not kill Debbie Carter. The warden plowed on, reading pages of rules regarding visitors, personal belongings, and funeral arrangements. Ron tuned him out and became subdued. "What should we do with your body?" the warden asked. Ron was emotional and confused and unprepared for such a question. Finally, he managed to suggest that they just ship him to Annette. When he had no questions and claimed he understood it all, he was marched back to his cell. The countdown began. He forgot to call Annette. 2 days later, she was riffling through her mail when she came across an envelope from the Department of Corrections in McAllister. Inside was a letter from a deputy warden. "Miss Hudson, it is with empathy that I must inform you that your brother, Ronald Keith Williamson, number 134846, is scheduled to be executed at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary at 12:01 a.m. on Tuesday, September 27, 1994. Visiting during the day prior to the execution date will be limited to clergyman, attorney of record, and two other persons who have been approved by the warden. As difficult as it may be, funeral arrangements must be considered, and these arrangements are the responsibility of the family. If this responsibility is not assumed by the family, the state will attend to the funeral. Please inform me of your decision. Sincerely, Ken Klingler." Annette called Renee with the horrible news. Both were distraught and worked hard to convince each other that it couldn't be true. Other conversations followed, and they decided that they would not bring his body back to Ada. It would not be put on display at Criswell's funeral home for the town to gawk at. Instead, they would have a private service and burial in McAllister, by invitation only. Only a few close friends and a few family members would attend. They were informed by the prison that they would be allowed to witness the execution. Renee said she couldn't do it. Annette was determined to be there at the end. The news swept through Ada. Peggy Stillwell was watching the local TV station when she heard the rather surprising report that an execution date had been set for Ron Williamson. Though this was good news, she was angry because no one had informed her. She had been promised that she would be allowed to witness the execution, and she certainly wanted to. Perhaps someone would call in a few days. Annette kept to herself and tried to deny it was happening. Her visits to the prison had become less frequent and shorter in duration. Ronnie was out of his mind and would either yell at her or pretend she wasn't there. Several times she had left after seeing him for less than 5 minutes. Chapter 13. Once the Oklahoma courts were finished with Ron's case and the date of execution was set, his attorneys hustled to federal court and began the next stage of appeals. The proceedings are known as habeas corpus, Latin for "you should have the body." A writ for habeas corpus required that an inmate be brought before the court to determine the legality of his detention. His case was assigned to Janet Chesley, a lawyer with the Indigent Defense System in Norman. Janet had extensive experience with habeas work and was accustomed to the frenetic pace of filing last-minute motions and appeals while watching the clock race toward an execution. She met with Ron, explained the process, and assured him he would get a stay. In her work, such conversations were not unusual, and her clients, though understandably jittery, always came to trust her. The execution date was serious, but no one was put to death until the habeas appeals had been exhausted. But Ron was different. The formal pronouncement of a date with death had pushed him even deeper into insanity. He was counting the days, unable to believe Janet's promises. The clock had not stopped. The death chamber was waiting. A week went by, then two. Ron spent much time in prayer and Bible study. He also slept a lot and stopped screaming. His drugs were being liberally dispensed. The row was quiet and waiting. The other inmates missed nothing and wondered if the state would really execute someone as insane as Ron Williamson. 3 weeks went by. The U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Oklahoma is in Muskogee. In 1994, there were two judges, neither of whom was particularly fond of habeas corpus appeals or jailhouse lawsuits. They came in by the truckload. Every prisoner had issues and complaints. Most claimed innocence and abuse. The death row boys had real lawyers, some from big firms working pro bono, and the briefs were thick and creative and had to be reckoned with. The general population prisoners were usually represented by themselves, with no shortage of advice from the writ writers who held sway in the law libraries and sold their opinions for cigarettes. If the inmates weren't filing habeas appeals, they were filing lawsuits over bad food, cold showers, mean guards, tight handcuffs, lack of sunlight. The list was long. Most prisoners' suits lacked merit and were dismissed outright, then sent to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver, home base for the sprawling federal district that included Oklahoma. The habeas corpus appeal filed by Janet Chesley was randomly assigned to Judge Frank C., a Jimmy Carter appointee who took the bench in 1979. Judge C. was from Seminole, and prior to his federal appointment, he had served for 11 years as the trial judge in the 22nd District, which included Pontotoc County. He was familiar with the courthouse there, and the town, and its lawyers. In May 1971, Judge C. had driven to the village of Asher and delivered a high school commencement speech. One of the 17 graduates was Ron Williamson. After 15 years on the bench, Judge C. had little patience with the habeas corpus appeals that landed in his office. The Williamson petition arrived there in September 1994, just a few days before the execution. He suspected, in fact, he knew, that the death penalty lawyers often waited until the last possible moment to file their petitions so that he and other federal judges would be forced to grant stays while the paperwork got sorted out. He often wondered what the poor convict was going through, sweating the hours on death row while his lawyers engaged in a bit of brinksmanship with a federal judge. But it was good lawyering, and though Judge C understood it, he still didn't like the process. He'd granted a few stays, but never a new trial in a habeas corpus matter. As always, the Williamson petition was first read by Jim Payne, a U.S. magistrate in the federal court office. Payne was known to have conservative leanings and a similar dislike for habeas work, but he was also highly regarded because of his innate fairness. It had been his duty for many years to plow through each habeas corpus filing and search for valid claims, which, though rare, did exist often enough to keep the reading interesting. To Jim Payne, the job was crucial. If he missed something buried in the voluminous briefs and transcripts, then an innocent man might be executed. Janet Chesley's petition was so well written that it captured his attention in the first paragraph, and by the time he finished it, he had some doubts about the fairness of Ron's trial. Her arguments centered on the issues of inadequate defense counsel, mental competency, and the unreliability of hair evidence. Jim Payne read the petition at home at night, and when he returned to the office the following morning, he met with Judge C and recommended a stay. Judge C had great respect for his magistrate, and after a long discussion about the Williamson petition, he agreed to stop the execution. After watching the clock and praying fervently for 23 days, Ron was informed that his execution had been delayed indefinitely. His brush with death had taken him to within 5 days of getting the needle. Jim Payne passed the habeas petition on to his law clerk, Gail Seward, who read it and agreed that an in-depth review was called for. He then gave it to the office rookie, a law clerk by the name of Vicky Hildebrand, who, because of her complete lack of seniority, had been assigned the unofficial title of death penalty clerk. Vicky had been a social worker before law school, and she had quickly and quietly assumed the role as the token bleeding heart in Judge C's moderate to conservative office. Williamson was her first habeas case involving the death penalty, and as she read his petition, she was captivated by the opening paragraph. "This case is a bizarre one about a dream that turned into a nightmare for Ronald Keith Williamson. His arrest came nearly 5 years after the crime, after Mr. Williamson's alibi witness was dead, and was based almost entirely on the confession, related as a dream, of a seriously mentally ill man, Ron Williamson." Vicky read on, and was soon struck by the paucity of credible evidence offered at his trial and by the haphazard strategies of his defense. When she finished it, she had strong doubts about Ron's guilt. And she immediately asked herself if she had the nerves for such a job. Would every habeas petition be so persuasive? Was she going to believe every death row inmate? She confided in Jim Payne, who devised a plan. They would draft Gail Seward, more of a centrist, and get her opinion. Vicky spent an entire Friday copying the lengthy trial transcript, 3 copies, one for each member of the conspiracy. Each spent the entire weekend reading every word of Ron's trial, and when they huddled early on Monday morning, the verdict was unanimous. From the right, left, and center, all agreed that justice had not been served. Not only were they certain the trial had been unconstitutional, they also believed Ron might very well be innocent. They were intrigued by the reference to the dreams of Ada. Janet Chesley's petition made much of the dream confession Ron had allegedly made. He had been reading the book shortly after his arrest, and had it in his cell when he gave his own jailhouse dream to John Christian. Published 7 years earlier, the book was out of print, but Vicky found copies in used bookstores and libraries. The three read it quickly, and their suspicions of the authorities in Ada were greatly magnified. Since Judge C was known to be rather abrupt when dealing with habeas matters, it was decided that Jim Payne would approach him and break the ice on the Williamson case. Judge C listened carefully, then got an earful from Vicky and Gail. The three felt strongly that a new trial was in order, and after hearing them out, the judge agreed to study the petition. He knew Bill Peterson and Barney Ward and most of the gang down in Ada. He considered Barney an old pal, but had never cared for Peterson. Frankly, he was not surprised at the sloppy trial and flimsy evidence. Strange things happened in Ada, and Judge C. had heard for years that the cops had a bad reputation. He was particularly bothered by the lack of control Judge Ronald Jones had exerted over the proceedings. Bad police work and slanted prosecutions were not unusual, but the trial judge was supposed to guarantee fairness. Nor was he surprised that the Court of Criminal Appeals had seen nothing wrong with the trial. When he became convinced that justice had not been served, he and his staff launched into a thorough review of the case. Dennis Fritz had lost contact with Ron. He had written one letter to his old friend, but it went unanswered. Kim Marks and Leslie Delk drove to Connor to interview Dennis in connection with their investigation. They brought the Ricky Joe Simmons video and played the confession. Dennis, like Ron, was angry that someone else had confessed to the murder they were convicted of committing, yet this information had not been available at his trial. He developed a correspondence with Kim Marks, and she kept him posted on the developments in Ron's case. As a fixture in the law library, Dennis heard all the legal gossip and knew the latest rulings from around the country. He and his fellow jailhouse lawyers missed nothing in the field of criminal procedure. DNA testing was first mentioned in the early 1990s, and he read everything he could find on the subject. In 1993, a segment of Donahue was devoted to four men who had been exonerated by DNA testing. The show found a wide audience, especially in the prisons, and served as a catalyst for the innocence movement across the country. One group that had already gained attention was the Innocence Project, founded in 1992 by two New York lawyers, Peter Neufeld and Barry Scheck. They set up shop in the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law as a non-profit legal clinic where students handled the casework while staff attorneys supervised. Neufeld had a long history of legal activism in Brooklyn. Scheck was an expert on forensic DNA and became famous as one of the attorneys for O.J. Simpson. Dennis watched the Simpson trial closely, and when it was over, he considered the possibility of contacting Barry Scheck. After receiving numerous complaints about H-Unit in 1994, Amnesty International conducted a thorough evaluation of the place. It found many violations of international standards, including treaties adopted by the United States and minimum rules set forth by the United Nations. The violations included cells that were too small, inadequately furnished, unlit, unventilated, windowless, and without access to natural light. Not surprisingly, the exercise yards were found to be unduly restrictive and much too small. Many inmates skipped their 1 hour a day so they could have the privacy of the cell without their roommate. Other than a high school diploma course, there were no educational programs, nor were the inmates allowed to work. Religious services were restricted. Isolation of individual prisoners was too severe. The food service needed a thorough review. In conclusion, Amnesty International found that conditions on H-Unit amounted to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment in violation of international standards. The conditions, when applied over a period of time, can have a detrimental effect on the physical and mental health of prisoners. The report was issued, but was not binding on the prison. It did add fuel to some of the prisoner lawsuits that had been filed. After a 3-year hiatus, the death chamber machinery cranked up again. On March 20, 1995, Thomas Grasso, male white, age 32, was executed after only 2 years on the row. Though it had been difficult, Grasso was able to stop his appeals and get things over with. Next came Roger Dale Stafford, the infamous steakhouse murderer, who had one of the more notable executions. Mass murders in big cities draw more press, and Stafford went out in a blaze of glory. He'd spent 15 years on death row, and his case was used by police and prosecutors, and especially politicians, as a prime example of the flaws in the appeals process. On August 11, 1995, a bizarre execution took place. Robert Burkine, a 40-year-old white male, barely made it to the death chamber. The day before, he swallowed a handful of painkillers that he had somehow smuggled in and stockpiled. His suicide was to be his final effort at telling the state to go to hell, but the state prevailed. Burkine was found unconscious by the guards and rushed to the hospital, where his stomach was pumped and he was stabilized enough to get hauled back to H Unit for a proper killing. Judge C directed his staff through a tedious evaluation of every aspect of the Williamson case. They pored over the transcripts, which included the preliminary hearing and every other court appearance. They cataloged Ron's lengthy medical records. They studied the police files and reports from the OSBI experts. The workload was divided among Vicki Hildebrand, Jim Payne, and Gail Seward. It became a group project, with no shortage of ideas and eagerness. The trial was rotten. A clear miscarriage of justice had occurred, and they wanted to correct it. Judge C had never trusted hair evidence. He had once presided over a federal death penalty case in which the star witness was to be the FBI's top hair expert. His qualifications were beyond reproach, and he'd testified many times, but Judge C was not impressed. The expert didn't testify and was sent away. Vicki Hildebrand volunteered for the research on hair evidence. For months, she read dozens of cases and studies and became convinced that it was all junk science. It was so wildly unreliable that it should never be used in any trial, a conclusion Judge C had long since reached. Gail Seward concentrated on Barney Ward and the mistakes he made at trial. Jim Payne tackled the Brady issues. For months, the team worked on little else, putting Williamson aside only to tend to pressing matters. There was no deadline on their work, but Judge C was a taskmaster who didn't tolerate an idle docket. They worked nights and weekends. They read and edited each other's work. As they peeled away more layers, they found more mistakes, and as the trial errors piled up, their enthusiasm increased. Jim Payne had daily briefings with Judge C, who, as expected, offered no shortage of comments. He read the team's initial drafts, did his editing, sent them back for more work. As it became obvious that a new trial would be ordered, the case began to bother Judge C. Barney was an old friend, an old warrior past his prime who would be deeply hurt by the criticism. How would Ada react to the news that their former judge had taken sides with the notorious killer, Ron Williamson? The team knew that their work would be scrutinized at the next level, at the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. What if they got reversed? Were they convinced enough in their cause? Could they argue so persuasively that the Tenth Circuit would be convinced? For almost a year, the team labored under the guidance of Judge C. Finally, on September 19, 1995, 1 year after the execution had been stayed, he issued a writ of habeas corpus and granted a new trial. The opinion accompanying the order was exhaustive, 100 pages long, and a masterpiece of judicial analysis and reasoning. In clear yet scholarly language, Judge C threw the book at Barney Ward, Bill Peterson, the Ada Police Department, and the OSBI, and though he held his fire on the unfortunate officiating by Judge Jones, he left little guesswork as to how he felt about it. Ron deserved a new trial for many reasons, chief among them ineffective assistance of counsel. Barney's mistakes were numerous and harmful. They included the failure to raise the issue of his client's mental competency, failure to thoroughly investigate and present evidence against Glenn Gore, failure to flesh out the fact that Terry Holland had also testified against Carl Fontenot and Tommy Ward, failure to inform the jury that Ricky Joe Simmons had confessed to the murder and had even done so on a videotape that Barney actually possessed, failure to attack Ron's confessions and suppress them before trial, and failure to call mitigating witnesses during the penalty phase. Bill Peterson and the cops were faulted for hiding the 1983 video of Ron's second polygraph, using confessions obtained by questionable means, including Ron's dream confession, calling to the stand and putting under oath jailhouse snitches, presenting a case with almost no physical evidence, and sitting on exculpatory evidence. Judge C. analyzed the history of hair evidence and ruled, rather dramatically, that it was too unreliable and should be banned from all courts. He criticized the OSBI experts for their mishandling of the samples in the Fritz and Williamson investigation. Bill Peterson, Judge Jones, and Judge John David Miller were faulted for not stopping the proceedings and inquiring into Ron's mental health. Judge Jones was wrong for holding a Brady hearing on exculpatory materials after the trial was over. His denial of Barney's request for a forensic expert to rebut the testimony from the OSBI gang was reversible error in itself. With the precision of a surgeon, Judge C. cut through every aspect of the trial and laid bare the mockery of Ron's conviction. Unlike the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, a tribunal that had examined the case twice, Judge C. saw a bad conviction and questioned everything. At the end of his opinion, he added something unusual, an epilogue. He wrote, "While considering my decision in this case, I told a friend, a layman, I believed the facts and the law dictated that I must grant a new trial to a man who had been convicted and sentenced to death. My friend asked, 'Is he a murderer?' I replied simply, 'We won't know until he receives a fair trial.' God help us if ever in this great country we turn our heads while people who have not had fair trials are executed. That almost happened in this case." As a courtesy, Judge C. sent a copy of his opinion to Barney Ward, with a note saying he was sorry, but he had no choice. Barney would never speak to him again. Though Vicki Hildebrand, Gail Seward, and Jim Payne felt strongly about their work, they were still somewhat apprehensive when it was made public. Giving a new trial to a death row inmate was not popular in Oklahoma. Ron's case had consumed their lives for a year, and though they were sure of themselves, they did not want Judge C. and his office criticized. "Prosecutors vow to fight order for new trial," read the headline in the Ada Evening News on September 27, 1995. On one side of it was a high school photo of Ron Williamson. On the other was one of Bill Peterson. The report began, "An angry Bill Peterson said that he would be more than happy to make an appearance before the United States Supreme Court, if necessary, in order to overturn a recent federal judge's ruling which has ordered a new trial for convicted Pontotoc County murderer Ronald Keith Williamson." Fortunately, at least for Peterson, he would not get the chance to go to Washington and argue the case. He went on to say that he had been assured by the state's attorney general that he, himself, would personally handle the immediate appeal to the Tenth Circuit in Denver. He was quoted as saying, "I'm flabbergasted, bumfuzzled, angry, confused, and a lot of other things. To have had this case go through so many appeals and so much scrutiny without ever having anyone question the conviction, and then for this opinion to come down, it simply doesn't make any sense." He neglected to say, and the reporter neglected to point out, that all death penalty convictions go the habeas corpus route and end up in federal court, where sooner or later an opinion of some sort is delivered. But Peterson was on a roll. He continued, "This case has been considered by the U.S. Supreme Court on two occasions, and on both occasions the court reaffirmed the convictions and denied the requests for rehearings." Not exactly. The U.S. Supreme Court never considered the merits of Ron's case. In fact, by denying certiorari, the court refused to hear the case and sent it back to Oklahoma. This was standard practice. Peterson saved his tallest tale for the end. Judge C. had cited, in a footnote to his opinion, Robert Mayer's book, The Dreams of Ada, and made a reference to the number of convictions based on dream confessions coming out of the same courtroom. Peterson was upset that the book had been mentioned in a court ruling and said, evidently with a straight face, "It is simply not true that any of these three men, Williamson, Fontenot, or Ward, were convicted based on dream confessions." The state of Oklahoma appealed Judge C's ruling to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. Though Ron was pleased with the turn of events and the prospect of a new trial, he was still in prison, surviving day by day as the process dragged on. He was not, however, fighting alone. Kim Marks, his investigator, Janet Chesley, his lawyer, and Dr. Foster were relentless in their efforts to obtain proper treatment. For almost 4 years, the prison had refused to admit Ron to its special care unit, where better medications and better conditions were available. The SCU was within view of H unit, an easy walk, but officially off-limits to death row inmates. Kim Marks reported this description of her client. "I was so frightened, not of him, but for him. I insisted that we try and get somebody higher up in the penal system to get some help, because his hair had grown out to his shoulders. He had yellow streaks in them where he'd been pulling because you could see the nicotine stains completely down his fingers and on his hands, not just on the tips. His teeth were literally rotting out of his mouth. I think he had been twisting them. His skin was gray because he had obviously not bathed in weeks. He was skin and bones. His shirt looked like it hadn't been washed, much less hung up or ironed, in months. And he was pacing. He could barely talk, and every time he did talk, spit would fly from his mouth. He was not making any sense whatsoever, and I was really afraid we were going to lose him, that he would die in prison from physical health problems related to his mental health problems." Janet Chesley, Kim Marks, and Ken Foster badgered the various wardens who came and went at McAllister, as well as deputy wardens and assistants. Susan Otto, the director of the Federal Public Defender's Office and Janet's supervisor, managed to pull some strings at the Department of Corrections. Finally, in February 1996, James Saffel, then a higher-ranking official with DOC, agreed to meet with Kim and Janet. As the meeting began, Saffel announced that he had authorized Ron Ward, the current warden at McAllister, to make an exception for Ron Williamson and to transfer him immediately to the SCU. Ron Ward's memo to the director of the SCU admitted that the unit was officially off-limits for death row inmates. It read, in part, "I am authorizing an exception to the standard operating procedures for the special care unit of the Oklahoma Penitentiary, which states, any OSP inmate except those on death row are eligible for special care unit services." What was behind this change of heart? 2 weeks earlier, a prison psychologist sent a confidential memo to a deputy warden concerning Ron Williamson. Among other comments, the psychologist gave some valid reasons for moving Ron to the SCU. "In our team discussion, we agreed that Mr. Williamson was psychotic and would likely benefit from major adjustment to his medication. We also noted that he has steadfastly refused even to consider or discuss any such adjustment. As you know, the special care unit has the latitude to force medicate when need be." The H unit staff was tired of Ron and needed a break. The memo went on. "There is little doubt that Mr. Williamson's condition is deteriorating week by week. I have noticed it, and H unit staff have brought it up regularly. Earlier today, Mike Mullins made emphatic mention of this deterioration and of the adverse effect the inmates' psychotic outbursts were having on our Southwest Quad. But the best reason to move Ron was to speed up his execution." The memo concluded, "In my opinion, as things stand now with Mr. Williamson, his psychosis has reached a level that would probably render him less than competent to be executed. A period at our SCU could well restore him to an appropriate level of competence." Ron was walked over to the SCU, admitted, and given a nicer cell with a window. Dr. Foster changed his medications and monitored their intake. Though Ron was far from healthy, he was quiet and not in constant pain. He was also extremely fragile, his mania barely under control. Progress was made. Then suddenly, on April 25th, after 3 months in the SCU, Ron was abruptly pulled out and taken back to H unit for 2 weeks. There was no medical authorization for the transfer. Dr. Foster was unaware of it. No reason was given. When he was returned to the SCU, he had regressed considerably. Dr. Foster sent a memo to the warden and described the damage the sudden transfer had inflicted on the patient. Coincidentally, Ron's sudden transfer on April 25th just happened to occur the day before another execution. On April 26th, Benjamin Brewer was put to death for stabbing a 20-year-old co-ed in Tulsa in 1978. Brewer had been on death row for over 17 years. Even though he was at the SCU, Ron was still a death row inmate. He couldn't be allowed to miss the drama of another killing at H Unit. Janet Chesley suspected the sudden transfer had something to do with the legal maneuverings. The state of Oklahoma had appealed Judge C's ruling to the 10th Circuit in Denver, and oral arguments were scheduled. To prevent her from arguing that her client was so mentally incompetent that he had been moved to the special care unit, Ron was moved back to H Unit. She erupted when she first heard of the transfer. She berated the prison officials and the attorneys for the state who were handling the appeals. Finally, she promised not to mention during her oral argument that Ron was in the SCU. He was moved back, but the damage was painfully clear. Dennis Fritz heard the good news that Ron had prevailed at the federal level and would get another trial. Dennis had not been so lucky. Since he was not under a death sentence, he had no lawyer and was forced to file his own habeas corpus petition. He had lost at the district court level in 1995 and was appealing to the federal 10th Circuit. Ron's retrial was bittersweet for Dennis. He was dejected because he was convicted by the same witnesses and the same set of facts, yet his habeas appeal had been turned down. At the same time, he was very pleased that Ronnie would get another day in court. In March 1996, he finally wrote the Innocence Project and requested their help. A student volunteer wrote back and sent a questionnaire. In June, the student requested Dennis's lab work, the analysis of his hair, blood, and saliva. Dennis had it neatly filed away in his cell, and he quickly sent it to New York. In August, he sent his appellate briefs, and in November, he sent his entire trial transcript. Later that month, he received the wonderful news that the Innocence Project had officially taken his case. Letters went back and forth. Weeks and months passed. The 10th Circuit denied his appeal. And when the Supreme Court refused to hear his case in May 1997, Dennis went through his own bout of depression. His appeals were over. All those wise judges sitting in their black robes and plowing through their thick law books had seen nothing wrong with his trial. Not a single one detected the obvious. An innocent man was wrongly convicted. The future of life in prison that he had so strongly refused to believe was now a possibility. In May, he sent four letters to the Innocence Project. In 1979, in the small town of Okarchi, just north of Oklahoma City, two men, Stephen Hatch and Glenn Ake, broke into the home of the Reverend Richard Douglas. In the ensuing ordeal, Douglas and his wife were shot and killed. Their two young children were also shot and left for dead. Somehow they survived. The killing was done by Glenn Ake, who was convicted and sentenced to death, then given a new trial because the judge had denied him access to a mental health expert. His appeal, Ake versus Oklahoma, was a landmark decision. At his second trial, he received a life sentence, which he is still serving. Stephen Hatch's participation in the killings was greatly in doubt and hotly disputed, but he nonetheless received the death penalty. On August 9, 1996, Hatch was strapped to the gurney and rolled into the death chamber on H Unit. Present in the witness room were the two Douglas children, adults by then. Glenn Ake, the unquestioned gunman, got life. Stephen Hatch, who killed no one, was executed. In 1994, a 20-year-old American Indian named Scott Don Carpenter robbed a store in Lake Eufaula and murdered the owner. After only 2 years on death row, he was able to stop his appeals and get the needle. On April 10, 1997, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver affirmed Judge C. The court took exception to his ban on hair evidence, but agreed that Ron Williamson had been wrongly convicted. With a new trial in order, Ron's case was moved to the Capital Trial Division of the Indigent Defense System, where the new director, Mark Barrett, supervised a team of 8 lawyers. Because of the complexity of the case, and because of his experience with Ron, he assigned the case to himself. The initial truckload of materials he received filled 16 boxes. In May 1997, Mark and Janet Chesley drove to McAllister to see the client. Janet's role was to reintroduce Mark to Ron. They had last seen each other in 1988, shortly after Ron arrived in F. Cell House and Mark was assigned his first appeal. Though he knew Janet and Kim Marks and most of the indigent appellate lawyers, and though he'd heard many rumors and tales of Ron and his adventures on death row, Mark was still startled at his condition. In 1988, Ron was 35 years old, weighed 220 pounds, and had an athletic build, confident walk, dark hair, and a baby face. 9 years later, he was 43 and could easily have passed for 65. After a year in the SCU, he was still gaunt, pale, disheveled, ghost-like, and obviously very sick. But he was able to remain engaged through a long conversation about his case. He rambled at times and drifted off into monologues that made no sense whatsoever. But for the most part, he knew what was going on and where his case was headed. Mark explained that DNA testing would compare Ron's blood, hair, and saliva samples with the hair and semen found at the crime scene, and that the conclusion would be certain, guaranteed, foolproof. DNA doesn't lie. Ron showed no hesitation. In fact, he was eager to have the testing done.
"I am innocent," he said over and over, "and I have nothing to hide."
Mark Barrett and Bill Peterson agreed that Ron should be evaluated to determine his mental competency. They also agreed on DNA testing. Peterson pushed hard for DNA because he was convinced it would finally nail Ron. The testing would have to wait, however, because Mark Barrett's austere budget wouldn't allow it. The cost was initially expected to be about $5,000, money that would not be available for a few months. It would eventually cost much more than the first estimate. Instead, Mark went to work on the competency hearing. He and his rather lean staff compiled Ron's medical records. They located a psychologist who reviewed the records, interviewed Ron, and was willing to travel to Ada to testify. After 2 trips to the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, a 1-year layover in Judge C's office, a 2-year stop at the 10th Circuit in Denver, 2 useless but required visits to the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington, and a truckload of routine filings back and forth among all these various courts, the matter of the state of Oklahoma versus Ronald Keith Williamson had now returned home. It was back in Ada, 10 years after 4 cops surrounded him, shirtless and shaggy and tinkering with a lawnmower with only 3 wheels, and arrested him for murder. Chapter 14. Tom Landreth was a third-generation native of Pontotoc County. He attended Ada High School and played on 2 state championship football teams. College and law school were at the University of Oklahoma, and when he passed the bar, he settled into his hometown and joined a small firm. In 1994, he ran for district court judge and easily defeated G.C. Mayhew, who had defeated Ronald Jones in 1990. Judge Landreth was well acquainted with Ron Williamson and the Carter murder, and when the 10th Circuit affirmed Judge C., he knew the case was headed back to Ada, to his courtroom. Typical of a small town, he had represented Ron on a drunk driving charge in the early 1980s. They briefly played on the same softball team. Landreth played high school football with Johnny Carter, Debbie's uncle, and Landreth and Bill Peterson were old friends. During Ron's murder trial in 1988, Landreth had slipped into the courtroom several times out of curiosity. Of course, he knew Barney well. It was Ada, and everybody knew everybody. Landreth was a popular judge, folksy and funny, but strict in his courtroom.